You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Riesling is a white grape variety which originated in the Rhine region of Germany, and it has a long history with several written references to it dating to the 15th century. Well, these days, it's the most grown white grape in Germany and in the French region of Alsace in a wide variety of styles. Comes in dry, semi-sweet, sweet, and sparkling wines. In terms of importance for quality wines, it's usually included in the top three white wine varieties, along with Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. Wine writers and sommeliers love it, so why isn't it more popular with consumers in this country? Well, Stephen Bitteroff, one of the people trying to answer that question and get more people to experience Rieslings, has founded an annual event which took place recently in New York called Riesling Fire. It translates into Celebration of Riesling. And he joins me now, along with one of Germany's most distinguished winemakers, Egon Müller IV. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show.
Thanks, Leonard. Thank
you. Often when I mention Rieslings to people in this country, they tell me they're too sweet. How did Rieslings get that reputation?
Well,
I mean, you make sweet wines, Egon.
Yes,
so,
yes.
And you're not embarrassed about
it.
But
I don't make any dry wines in Germany, so I know what I'm talking about. I think what you have to first accept is that sweet is not sweet, or not always sweet. What it comes down to is that you want to have balanced wines. And when the winemaker has done a good job in getting the right balance, balance between sugar and acidity, then you do not really ask yourself anymore, is this wine sweet or is it dry? It's just balanced. And why has German wine such a reputation for being sweet? I think in the 1970s, 1980s, things have been over the top. And people have been trying to sell mediocre wines that have been made sweet so that the consumers wouldn't realize how simple they were actually.
Because sugar can cover up an awful lot of sins.
Yes, yes, yes.
Absolutely.
And for a long time it was too easy.
Yeah. But Stephen, there, although Egon doesn't make dry wines, there are dry Rieslings. Trocken is the word you look for on the label.
Absolutely, yeah. Trocken is, you know, translates as dry. A lot of the newer Riesling labels are just putting dry on them to make it a little bit clear. And I think the fascination, obsession, and problematic issues with sugar in a lot of ways were created by the Germans themselves with this 1971 wine law, the famous German wine law that really put the emphasis on sugar. And what happened with that is then all of a sudden, you know, if you make sugar and you make ripeness the goal, the absolute pinnacle of wine, as opposed to what Egon talks about being balance and key, balance and freshness and clarity really being central, people are going to focus on sugar. So at this point, you have, you know, dry Rieslings or Rieslings that are very, very low in residual sugar, and that is a very common historical reality in Germany. But you have dry wines, people go, oh, that's dry Rieslings. People say, that's a little bit sweet. And if you were actually to do the analytics, comparing that to a California Chardonnay, it would have less residual sugar, but people are just so used to thinking about sugar and Riesling.
But how much of this is also a matter of export? Because I have found it hard to buy dry Rieslings in most of the wine shops in New York City. Why don't more of them stock them?
It's changing dramatically, I would say. You know, myself as an importer as well at the moment, I see probably dry Rieslings growing in terms of sales as opposed to the fruity ones, the sweet ones that are more traditional, at least in the U.S. At the same time, there's a place for both. And to Egon's point, you know, you will see more and more dry Rieslings in the best wine stores and restaurants around New York and around the country, but you can have everything.
Well, the sommelier will often suggest it, and one told me when I ordered a Riesling, I love this wine, he said, but you're the first person to have ordered it. Egon, is another problem the German wine labels, which carry so much information that it can be confusing to all but the most knowledgeable buyers or people who don't speak German?
Well, that is something I am not excusing that excuse anymore. I really think that in Germany, with the climate that we have, with the difficulty ripening our grapes every year, and with the huge differences that you get from one plot to the next, it's really important to be very specific on the label. And
because Riesling has been called terroir expressive, that means that you can really taste the difference if it was grown on this hill or the hill next to it?
Yes, and I think when you talk to winemakers, you will very often hear that Riesling is the grape that can really show best what people are doing with it. Somebody once told me the Riesling is a grape that can pick up whether the winemaker smokes.
And I would say, Leonard, too, you know, in terms of the specificity and the complexity of German wines and German wine labeling, no doubt it's there. At the same time, for me, you know, one of the most popular and successful regions currently is Burgundy. And Burgundy parallels German winemaking on so many fronts. And that liability, the complexity of vineyard site, the complexity of pronouncing the French words, that's become an asset because people want that specificity and they want detail.
But I got to admit, I get confused sometimes when I see a bottle that says QBA and then another one says QMP and then another one is a Cabernet, another one is a Spätlese, another one is an Auslese, and then there's Truck and Beer and Auslese. Yeah. And after a while, I'm wondering, what does all of that mean?
I would say the most important things for a consumer to focus on right now in the U.S. in thinking about and trying German wines is don't worry about QMP and QBA. Those are quality levels that to some extent are less relevant now than they were when they were created. Find a good merchant, as you would with Burgundy or with Champagne or with anything else that's frankly complicated. Find a good wine store and talk to them and buy by producer and worry less about those because you'll find what you like and you'll be able to parse it through that way.
Well, Riesling has been called the most food-friendly of all white wines. Why do you think that is?
Well, to come back to the last question, I would say one very important thing is you have to find out what your taste is because there's so many styles with Riesling. And once you know what your taste is, your personal taste, then it's much easier. And all these designations that you just mentioned will only help you to find what you like. But food-friendly is because Riesling generally doesn't have so much alcohol.
Because it's grown in colder climates?
In Germany, yes. In Germany, I know that I make some Riesling in Australia, and there we always finish between 13, sometimes even 13.5 alcohol. So low alcohol really is something that is specific to Germany. Mm-hmm. And that is what, in my opinion, is really the most important thing that makes Riesling so versatile as food.
And I would say, too, Leonard, for me the key thing is one word. It's acidity. And, you know, this obsession with sugar and Riesling and everything else, the reason that sugar is such an important part of a Riesling, whether it's dry or sweet, is because Riesling has an ungodly amount of acidity. It is a dagger. And you need that sugar to kind of balance that, and the acidity is what provides freshness, what provides invigorates the palate and plays with the food and makes it, you know, after a bite you want to go back for more. That's key, and that's what Egon's wines do better than almost anything on planet Earth.
My guests are Stephen Bitterolf, who is a wine importer, and Egon Müller IV, who is one of the most famous winemakers in the world, specializing in Riesling. 96%, I gather, of your vineyards are planted in Riesling. 100%. Ah, somebody was cheating on that 4%. Riesling is also an important grape in Alsatian wines. And are they very different from the ones that are made in Germany, where some of the grapes are from really old vines?
Well, I have very good friends in Alsace, and I get to drink quite a good amount of Alsace wines, and I get to drink some of the very best ones. And I think that in Alsace you already have a warmer climate, which gives you a completely different style already, and then you have a variety of soils that is quite amazing for such a small region. So when you talk about different styles in Germany, you have the same thing in Alsace too.
Well, in Germany, you got all these different areas. You have the Mosel, the Rheingau, the Nahe, the Pfalz, they're all producing different kinds of Rieslings. And then you have Alsace, and then you mentioned you're in Australia. Austria makes a lot of Rieslings, and then Slovakia, Hungary, and in this country, upstate New York, Oregon, Washington, Rieslings are made in Canada. If I were to slip you a glass of Riesling made in one of those other places, not tell you where it was from, would you immediately be able to say, oh, this is from Austria, oh, this one is from Washington State?
I have a 50-50 chance.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I've done a number of tastings like that, you know, all blind. And I would say slightly better than 50-50. In terms of locating, this is Finger Lakes versus Oregon versus Australia. That's more difficult. I would say, you know, Mosel, perhaps Nahe, Rheinhessen versus the others, it is slightly better than 50-50, but it's difficult.
Well, Egon, yours is probably the most highly praised estate in Germany. But you also make not only some of the greatest, but the most expensive white wines in the world. You have wines that range from $5,000 a bottle to $14,000 a bottle. Why? And I realize that you can get Riesling for a lot less than that. But what would make a wine worth $14,000 a bottle?
What makes a stamp worth 100,000.
It's the rarity?
Yeah. One big point, of course, is rarity. And then you have to have at least one person who wants to have it. Yeah. And if you have this consumer or this group of consumers who think that it's worthwhile to spend this amount of money on anything, then you get these prices.
But yeah. I would also assume that it's partly because these are difficult wines to make. You're handpicking each grape and making sure that you're going to come up with a wine that is unlike any other wine.
Yes, but that is only part of the story. If we didn't have the consumers who were ready to spend this kind of money, then we wouldn't get it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, the translation from effort in the vineyard to price in the bottle doesn't always go on a logical scale. You know, you look at Bordeaux, which makes great wines, is not a bash against Bordeaux, but it's, you know, relatively less labor. They make a tremendous amount of wine, and they fetch astronomical prices. And then you have wines, you know, such as Egon makes that are extraordinarily expensive to make, that are ungodly rare. And they're expensive, clearly. And, you know, the reason that they're worth this amount of money is that someone will pay for it. But it's not a logical kind of one-to-one, unfortunately.
Is it your sense that more Americans are open to drinking Rieslings than they were in the past?
Absolutely, 100%.
Is that partly because sommeliers in some of the better restaurants will suggest them?
Absolutely. You know, I think the evolution of Riesling in German wine, I should say, in the U.S., you know, since the 70s, 80s, in the 80s, 90s, even early 2000s, I would say it was still the sommeliers, the critics. You know, every single sommelier I speak with, wine director, they say Riesling is one of the greatest grapes, especially German wine, one of the greatest wines on the face of the earth. It's a canonical wine. It's Champagne, Bordeaux, German wine. These are the wines, if this were, you know, 1880 and we were the aristocrats, we would have white wine, it would be German, and we'd have red wine, it'd be Bordeaux. And, you know, if we lived regionally, we'd be some Burgundy. But these were the great canonical wines. And at this point, finally, the sommeliers and the critics, it is coming down. And the collectors who have been buying Burgundy and who have been buying Bordeaux and want that lightness, they want freshness, clarity, they want detailed wines, they're coming to German wines.
But you can still get a Riesling for relatively little money, can't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there are a number of wines. I import one wine that is sourced from 80-year-old ungrafted vines. It's all hand-harvested. The slopes are incredibly steep, and it retails for $17 to $19 a bottle.
Now, Egon, the Riesling is, as we said earlier, can make dry wines, what they call semi-sweet wines, can make sweet wines of many different sorts. There's ice wines, and then there are late harvest wines, and there are wines that also are affected by a kind of a rot, the way that Sauternes are. And then there's also sparkling Riesling. Is this grape just capable of doing anything?
I haven't seen a red Riesling. But otherwise, pretty much anything is possible.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for being on our show. Perhaps we've convinced a few people to give Riesling a chance if they haven't.
Hopefully.
My guests have been Stephen Bitteroff, who is a wine importer and also the creator of Riesling Fire, which is an annual event that is intended to get more people to try Rieslings, and Egon Müller IV, the fourth in a long line of great winemakers. His vineyard is one of the greatest in the world. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.